So speaking of wind blowing, I used to live in Boulder, and we had I was talking with Manfred about this earlier. We used to have what we called Chinooks, which are these very strong winds that would come down off of the Front Range of the Rockies. And I remember that walking out of my chemistry class, and there was a girl in front of me carrying a spiral notebook full of her chemistry notes. And the wind actually would get up sometimes over 100 miles an hour. They had very severe winds in Boulder, as you probably remember. And it grabbed this notebook out of her hand, and it flew 20 feet away. And then the wind started pulling out page after page of notes, and they went flying off. And that's what happened to my talk. So I was in Santa Barbara on Monday, and I gave this talk, and I left it there. It didn't make its way back to me. So I've spent the last 3 days reconstructing that talk in PowerPoint, my first PowerPoint talk. And I did, I have to say, an absolutely beautiful, beautiful job, if I can say so. But we have a slight technical snag that the my UXGA screen is not quite communicating with this object right here, so I can't run it in full screen mode. That's the only thing you get to miss, is kind of the very smooth, you know, going through a PowerPoint talk. Yeah. For example. All right, so, but what I am going to talk about today is some more experiments that we've been doing at the wet lab at Courant. And these experiments are very similar to the experiments I told you about last time with respect to flags. Instead of flags which are kind of hanging down, this is what happens when you take an elastic object and you hang it sideways in a flow. All right? And it brings up very classical problems in a new setting, namely drag. And the new part of it is how does a body change the way it invokes drag when that body itself can be changed by the flow? So, for example, like a leaf, if a leaf is attached to a tree, the wind's blowing around it. If the wind's strong, you'll observe that a leaf starts to bend, and it will, in some species, even curl up into a cone. Now, that has the benefit or the effect of reducing the rate at which drag grows as a consequence of the wind. And so that's actually where this was initially motivated, was asking, in nature, bodies often have flexibility, and might this have benefit for them in surviving? All right, so those are my collaborators. And so let me just say a bit about each of them. June, you've heard me mention before. He's the experimentalist in our laboratory. Matthew Shu, here you get to see a bit of New York, both in the past and in the present. Matthew was born in mainland China and immigrated and lives in Queens in New York. And he goes to Stuyvesant High School, which is a very well-known science high school in New York City. Has a Dutch name from the beginnings of New York back in the 1500s from Peter Stuyvesant. And Silas Alban is a graduate student at Courant who's working with me on this as well. And a good deal of the technical work that I talk about today will be in collaboration with him. All right, so there's the... Can you see this well enough? You're probably missing... If it helps, you might move forward. I can't do anything about it. All right? But... So last time I talked about this soap film apparatus, and in that we studied the flapping of a flexible string that was held fixed in the soap film, and looked at the dynamics of that as an example of a one-dimensional flag and a two-dimensional wind. And that's what I talked about last time. You can't see it quite so well in this particular figure, but there's the place at which it's fixed. This is the soap film flowing down around this object, which is in the middle of a flap, and is shedding behind it this complicated wake. Okay? So now the only difference is that we're going to take this same experiment. Instead, you'll notice this has ceased to be a snake and instead is something that's spanning the flow. All right? So what happens then? The main thing you have to do is you make sure you don't induce a translational motion on your mouse button when you hit, or it leaves the domain. So, you like that? Yeah? So, what you're seeing here now is what happens when you just take a rigid bar, actually just a pretty rigid piece of plastic, a plastic filament. It's being supported right here in the middle, and the flow is going down around it. The scale on this is about 3 centimeters across, and to give you a scale, this is somewhere around 10 centimeters, 12 centimeters across in this soap film flow tunnel. Now, there we go. And so the elements of the flow, and this is a very classical problem, right? Flow around an obstacle. And it has, in this soap film illustration of it, you see all the things that you learn about in fluid mechanics. You have a flow, it's coming down from above. Remember that this is a gravity-fed device. It has to flow around this object, so you start getting diverging of the flow field as it comes down. And it goes down around a wake structure here, actually where the flow is very slow. So this, if you could see it, would, in some very rough way, for example, be just the flow that you would see behind. If I just took this book and I held it up into a strong wind, and you could somehow visualize the flow or the velocity field behind it, it would have that structure. It'd be coming down, diverging in the neighborhood of this surface, going around it, and in the process of going around it, creating a wake structure behind. And it's actually this wake that has a lot to do with the drag. It's creating this wake has a lot to do with the drag that the object feels, for example. So just to give you some numbers to make you understand a bit more of what I mean by a wake here, right out here, this film is flowing at about 200 or 300 centimeters per second, typically. It's very fast, right? 1 second, it's gone all a piece of fluid has gone all the way down from the top to the bottom of the experimental apparatus. This scale is about, 7 or 8 centimeters. You can sit there and you can watch it move by eye. That means that relative to what's going on out here, this is very slow. Okay? It's essentially stagnant. It looks very beautiful. It's very complicated. It has all this vertical, apparent vertical structure in it, but it's a very slow flow compared with what's going on outside. So what I want to talk about is this very classical question, which is drag. So the drag is simply the force that's required to hold that body in place against the oncoming flow. So this rigid bar is being supported on another bar. It's just glued to it like this. What's the force that bar is feeling to keep the obstacle in place against the flow? That's drag. We're very concerned about drag in all sorts of terrestrial settings. What's the drag on your car? What's the drag on a Corvette versus the drag on a Chevette? Things like this. Okay, so what's the drag? As I said, it's the force required to hold the body in place against the oncoming flow. Here's a flow schematic. So here is my flow domain, blue, and I have fluid flowing in at the top. Say it has some velocity u. Here's my object, and it's flowing around it. This blue domain, the fluid in it is governed by the Navier-Stokes equations, which I've written in a very abbreviated form here. Rho du dt is the divergence of the stress tensor, and I have a divergence-free condition. And I'll remind you that the stress tensor is what you use to evaluate or to measure the force that the fluid exerts on another piece of fluid or on an object. And so if I simply take... Now, I'm just going to say this is not... I'm going to assume this is a surface rather than some sort of volume, okay? So it has a normal. And if I take the jump in the stress tensor across that surface, dot it with the normal, and take the integral, that's the force that's being exerted on that object. All right? To hold it in place, I have to have exerted an equal force. In particular, I'm asking against the flow, so the flow's coming in the y-hat direction, so I say the drag is minus the y component of the force felt on this body. All right? That's the drag. Now, in the case of Euler's equation, the only stress is a normal stress. It's the pressure stress. And in that case, the drag is simply the integral over the body of the pressure jump across the body, times the normal, and then I needed a y dot. I forgot a y dot there. Okay? Did agree, yeah. Thank you very much. The computer agrees with you. Okay. Now. Okay. Now, what I'm going to look at today are steady flows. Okay, so unlike the other four talks, this is going to be a steady flow talk. See how far we can get with that. And so in that case, if I have a steady Euler flow, then it turns out that the Euler equations, or the Navier-Stokes equations, in the case where they don't have this viscous term in them, can be reduced through an integration to Bernoulli's equation. And it's just a relation between the pressure and the velocity. All right? And now those flow equations in the steady Euler case just reduce to this statement that the pressure plus 1/2 rho u squared is a constant everywhere. And I've set a kind of a fiduciary constant for the pressure by just setting that constant equal to 1/2 rho u squared. Okay? So in the outer flow, this is what the pressure and velocity have to mutually satisfy, is the Bernoulli equation. Okay? And now I've also put in here a length scale for my body. I'll say it has length L. So I'm going to look at this problem. Now, it turns out that I have three parameters in the problem. I have the density, I have the oncoming velocity, I have the length L. All right? Turns out that they can all be removed through rescalings or non-dimensionalization of my problem to give myself a unit length and a unit velocity and so forth. What that means is that I can just scale that out of the scale that density and length and velocity out of the Bernoulli equation, so I just have a unitless relation. I have a body of unit length and an oncoming velocity at infinity, say, of unit magnitude. What that means is that the drag, the dimensional drag, has to have the following form. It looks like 1/2 the density, u squared, times the length, times a factor that comes from solving that dimensionless flow problem. And that can only depend on the geometry of the body. All right? So that's what, for this Euler flow, what the drag has to look like. It has to scale with the geometrical factor, and in particular, it has to scale with the square of the velocity. So that's a prediction. As I increase the velocity, the drag must go up like it's square. All right? That's what I want to beat. So that's a body of a fixed geometry. All right, so the drag should grow quadratically with u. And here is a drag measurement from the experiment for that rigid plate as the velocity is increased from 100 to 300 centimeters per second, more or less. Here's the data. There's a fit that I'm showing you right here. This x in the fit is really the velocity, and you see you have an exponent which is very close to 2. So the experiment is giving results that are very consistent with that prediction. All right? The drag more or less increases as the square of the velocity. All right. Now I want to ask the question, what if the body's flexible? It's not a rigid body. All right? So, and the motivation from this comes from earlier studies by Vogel and his comment that if the leaves of a tree were stiff and they didn't change their conformation in a wind, they were like plates, then trees would not stand under strong winds. All right? And so, in particular, as the wind speed increases, we know that a leaf will bend more and more because it's an elastic object. Does this reduce at least the growth of drag? That's the question. And in particular, if I looked at a problem where my body could bend, what would my drag look like? Would this geometrical factor now be a function of u? Okay, so my body geometry becomes then a function of the velocity. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. So here's a flexible filament in a soap film. All right? Let me just say that this filament, it's a piece of nylon fiber that you get from the Shakespeare Fishing Company. It turns out they have an industrial fiber division, and they'll send you samples of their industrial fibers that look just like fishing line to me. But if it's in no flow, this is just a straight object. All right? Now it's in a flow, and can't quite see it so well there. So let me highlight some stuff for you here. Here's the end, and it's been bent. There's where it's being held at the tip, and it's coming down to that end. All right? The main thing is that the flow is deforming this fiber very strongly. You still have the same kind of flow structure. The flow is coming down around here on the outside, and you have a very slow wake. Okay? Let me give you some numbers again. In this particular experiment, the flow coming in from above is about 135 centimeters per second. The rigidity, which is a measure of how easily, how flexible this is, the more rigid it is, the higher this number E is whatever, it's 8.2 something, erg centimeters, and it's a length of 3 centimeters. That's how long it is. Now, what happens if I ramp up the velocity in this experiment? Well, it does what you expect it to do. Here it is now at nearly twice the velocity, and you can see the wake is decreased in width because I've actually made this whole shape much more streamlined. Okay, it's presenting much less of a cross-section to the flow. And to set your eye again a little bit, now here's where the ends are. They've been dragged down further. There's the tip, and so on. Yes?
What is the typical Reynolds numbers?
About 10,000.
And it's stationary, does not stop fluctuating?
Let me back up. That's a good question. So this, in these experiments, this is the fiber itself is not vibrating. There's a lot of time dependence in various portions of the flow. For example, here's this free stream out here. You have a rapid transition in the flow velocity to something which is relatively stagnant. So there's a shear layer here which is unstable to a Kelvin-Helmholtz instability, and you see it locally all the time. It's always generating little vortices along the side, and that's partly what's driving these kind of large-scale circulation structures inside the wake. But no, in the experiment, at least to the eye, these are not moving. You can get it to flutter if you take the support point off to the side, or perhaps if you could take the flow velocity even higher, you'd be able to get it to start fluttering. But in the range I'm talking about here, it doesn't. All right, so there's the drag on the flat plate as we saw before, and here's the drag now on that flexible filament. Okay? So two things. One, the drag's a lot lower. That's clear. It's the same length, same range of velocities. It has much lower drag. The main thing I'm after is it looks like it's growing with a different power or dependence on U. I'm not just after a smaller coefficient on this U squared law. I'm saying, is it a different law? And that's what I want to try to get my hands on. So here, there's been a fit again, and there's something around a power of 3/2. It looks like I'm going to claim, or I'm going to make a guess that it's actually 4/3, and I'll show you why I think that's the case. Okay.
Do you expect it to be 4/3? No
matter theory predicts. Theory predicts 4/3.
Regardless of the rigidity.
The rigidity comes into a scaling. I'll show you where it shows up. All right? So the drag is very much reduced, and it grows apparently with a different dependence upon the velocity. And so this is what I want to understand. And the main point I want to make here is that this is a very undone problem, classical problem. It's a prototype for kind of a coupled free boundary problem, okay? So if I'm going to solve this problem, I have to consider both the solution of the flow coupled very intimately with the deformation of the domain. They're the same problem. I have to solve them both at once. All right, so here's my schematic. Now, you have to see why I'm quite proud of this, this being my first computer presentation. I had to sit down and figure out how to make things like that, because I like to draw on slides. So, all right, so what I'm going to do, as I may have intimated earlier, is I want to look for steady solutions to the incompressible irrotational Euler equation. So I'm going to assume that viscosity is not important most everywhere, though I'll indicate where it gives certain certain inviscid flow structures, and irrotational, which means everywhere in the fluid I'm going to assume that there's no vorticity, and that's roughly true in the experiment. And that this is going to be flow around a formable body with a trailing wake. So here's my flow structure right here. I have my flowing fluid coming down. It's going around some body. It's bending the body. And it comes down around, and there's a dividing streamline where I have free flow out here and then a no-flow wake. So I'm going to take myself to the limit where I'm going to look for solutions where not just that it's slow in the wake, but it doesn't move. All right? It has no velocity. All the velocity sits out here. Now, the main point, again, I just want to emphasize is that in this particular problem, the flow, the deforming body, and the wake is expressed through actually the determination of a dividing streamline. All of these have to be found simultaneously and self-consistently, okay, because each determines the other.
So you assume the streamline is tangent to the shape of the fiber?
Yes. So we look for smooth, sufficiently smooth flow profiles, and that's a condition. All right, so in the flow, then, I'm going to assume Bernoulli's equation. So now I'm putting it in non-dimensional form again, and I'll show you where the rigidity comes in. All right, so in the flow, I'm going to have just a potential flow, and U and the pressure satisfy the Bernoulli equations. At infinity, I'm going to have a parallel flow coming in. So U is just minus Y coming straight down and zero pressure. So I can see if I go off to infinity in this equation, modulus of U becomes 1, so the pressure is 0. On the body, on my deformable body, I have a no-flow condition. The normal component of the velocity has to be 0. Can't penetrate the body. And at this point is what's called the stagnation point. There's a point on the body where the velocity is 0. So it's where there is one streamline that comes in and terminates there, and it's like a hyperbolic point for the flow where it divides the stream into either side, and there you have what's called the stagnation pressure. The pressure has to be a half, especially if I had remembered to put the half inside of that equation right there. Okay. Now, and then I have a dividing streamline where the pressure is zero, or the pressure matches a stagnation pressure, or rather a cavity pressure inside. So the velocity is 1 there, and there's the wake. Constant pressure, 0 velocity. So that's the problem, okay? That's the fluid mechanics problem. And it turns out this is a very classical problem. People have been solving this for over 100 years. Yay, yes. All right. And so this problem is solved by a method called free streamline theory. It's a conformal mapping problem. I have a potential flow, so the potential has to be a harmonic function. It was first used by Helmholtz in 1868, followed closely by Kirchhoff, developed in its more modern form by Levi Civita and Villa. And what free streamline theory does is, given the body, it determines the flow field and the free streamline positions by solving a conformal mapping problem. Okay? Actually, this whole thing gets mapped onto a semi-disc, and you have to solve this mapping problem. If you want references to that whole technology, I can be happy to give them to you. All right, so the fluid side's under control. Okay, well-known method for the problem as I've set it up. Now, the body we model as an inextensible elastic beam, like very close to this piece of nylon fiber. All right? And what we're going to assume is that the tensile forces of the beam and the bending forces of the beam have to balance the pressure forces that the fluid exerts on it. There's only pressure forces. There are no viscous drag forces because there's no viscosity, only pressure. Okay, so here's my body sitting there supported on its point. And this is the force balance equation that we use. So this is a tension force here. This is the tension T right here, the actually solved force. So this is an axial force. And these are the bending forces. This is classic Euler-Bernoulli elasticity. And it's being balanced against the pressure forces, which only act in the normal direction. So here, I've written just P of S. P is the pressure the fluid exerts on the upper part of this bendable plate, and is zero inside, so the pressure jump is just P itself. And there's a coefficient here that contains all the fun, and I'll tell you what that is in a second. The boundary conditions are the classical ones. It's clamped in the center, which means I'm specifying the angle. I've got it glued onto a post. I'm specifying the angle that this beam it presents to the flow at a point. And I have what are called free ends for the elastica, or the elastic beam, says the curvature derivative, and the tension is zero. That's saying there's no forces, no moments acting on the end. Now, it turns out that this beam equation, if you break it up into its normal and tangential components, you can, in this steady flow case, you can explicitly determine what the tension is. All right? It's just minus 1/2 the curvature squared. And what that lets you do is to take this vector equation and just write it as a single scalar equation, a nonlinear scalar equation for the curvature of the beam. So I'll call this the beam equation. So the cube, that's the tension force, plus the second derivative of the curvature, that's the bending force, has to be balanced by this pressure jump with some coefficient there. All right? And now I just have boundary conditions on the curvature. Now here's the important quantity. There's only one non-dimensional parameter in this problem as I've set it up. It's this eta squared. Okay? Now this eta squared is, you can represent it as a ratio of the fluid kinetic energy on the on a length scale of flow around this object in the flow to the elastic energy of this piece of fiber. And in particular, here's the fluid kinetic energy, 1/2 the fluid density. Here's F. F is the film thickness for the soap film. There's the length of the fiber squared times the velocity squared, and then this rigidity, I'll remind you, had dimensions of energy times length, and so E over the length is an energy. So that's the elastic energy sitting there. Yes?
The
curvature cubed actually comes, it comes right out of a Fernet-Soret product rule on those terms. So, yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. I'm not quite sure how to answer that right now. Yeah. After the talk, I'll think of how to answer it. But what I do want you to do is to focus on this particular object. All right? Now, the one thing I want you to notice is that this eta, by the way I've kind of formed it, has units of a dimensionless velocity, right? U, eta squared, u squared. Okay, so it looks like a dimensionless velocity. So this guy will go up with the velocity scale. On the other hand, if I increase the rigidity, it's as though I had decreased the velocity. Okay, because it becomes more rigid and it won't bend as much. And you can play with the length and so forth and the film thickness in the same way. So I prefer to think of it as either dimensionless velocity or something that looks like an inverse square root of rigidity. An inverse square root of a rigidity if I took a square root. Oh, F is the film thickness of the soap film. This is an Euler theory. If I want to relate to this thin film flow, then I have to talk about a transverse length scale to get the forces right. Okay, so this was Silas's summer project, actually, was this problem, was to combine free streamline theory with a boundary value solver for the beam equation. All right? And so the free streamline theory, we use a formulation of Hérault and his colleagues. It's a nice formulation for us because it uses very explicitly as part of the solution, it wants to know what the tangent angle of the obstacle is. That's nice because we're dealing with curvature in the boundary value problem, and the derivative of a tangent angle is a curvature, so it kind of relates nicely geometrically. And what this will produce are the flow variables U, P, and the free streamline positions. On the other hand, we have a boundary value problem to solve as well, where if we're given the pressure, then we can solve for the curvature by doing marching from the free ends into the middle in this beam equation. That lets us apply these free end boundary conditions in the curvature equation. Then we can solve for the tangent angle by integration of the curvature. That lets us apply the clamp at the center. That specifies the tangent angle. And then we can do an integration of the tangent angle through its relation to the unit tangent vector to reconstruct the position. And that tells you I have a fixed point at the center where I'm holding everything. Okay, so the elements of the numerical solution are you end up with a large coupled nonlinear system for the flow and body variables, second-order accuracy in space. The system size in this case varies with the number of points I use to describe the rod, the discretization of the rod. And we solve this system by a damped Royden rank 1 update scheme, and we use continuation in eta. So that's all I'm going to say about that. And now let me show you a solution. So it's a little light on the screen, but what I'm showing you here is for eta equal to 74, I'm showing you the streamlines around a bent body, all right, satisfying that beam equation. And here the body ends, and you go into the free streamline, and there's a wake behind it. Okay, so that's just a solution. That's what the pressure field looks like around this object. This actually extends off into the whole plane. You just everything is expressed in terms of representations on the bent body, and you can reconstruct everything from that. So this is now, again, the flow coming in from the left. Here's the pressure field. Here's the stagnation pressure at a half sitting here in this region in front. There's a very sharp gradient in the pressure as I go towards the end of the filament, and it goes down to the wake pressure. So you can see all the bending is being done up here. All right, so that's a consistent solution to the Euler equations flowing around a deformable body. Okay? Now, what I'm showing you here is this numerical solution for the body shape as I go over 6 decades of scaling in eta. So I'm obviously able to do much more in my numerical solution than I can in my experiment. That's nice, I guess. But here's what I want to point out to you. So eta is this non-dimensional velocity. So just think of it as u. If I have very small velocities, this is the solution. It's this rigid plate. It hardly bends. For a value of eta, which is order 1, it starts to bend and then rapidly afterwards deforms. Okay, so what's happening is that it's something like a buckling instability, if you like. That when the flow gets high enough, suddenly I can just start to buckle this rod, and it buckles very quickly with increases in the velocity. So I have a rigid regime where it acts like a flat plate in this non-dimensional flow parameter. There's a transition and then a very flexible plate. Okay? Now, what's the drag look like on this? And this is where it gets more interesting. The numerical solution are these red hatches. Okay? And here again, this is the 6-7 decades scaling in my non-dimensional parameter eta. So for low velocities, there's this rigid plate scaling, and the blue is just a line that we fit to the last 2 data points. All right? Actually, to the last data point. It's a line that has slope 4/3. We specified the slope. Or 2, we specified the slope. And here, at that about that value of eta equals 3.3, it underwent a very abrupt transition, and it went to a slower growth in the drag. I changed the power of the drag as a function of my non-dimensional velocity. This is what I was after. Okay? So I have a 4/3 sitting there, apparently. So what I want to do is explain to you where the 4/3 comes from. Okay, is that clear? Well, I think that the flexible data is actually sitting here in the transition region, which is what's giving it some other power, perhaps. It's not well fit. Okay? And we're doing more experiments now to try to fill out this range. I'll show you that at the end. All right, so that's the picture. At low the velocities, I see a rigid plate scaling. It looks like eta squared. Around eta equal to 1, there's a transition velocity at eta 3. That's just basically where these two lines cross. There's nothing magical about 3.3. There's a whole transition region in here. I'm just picking a representative value. And then I have some new scaling giving me a reduced growth of the drag. Okay, and this has to do with where now this plate can bend and get out of the way. Okay, so what's the scaling? So if eta is small, then everything is a regular perturbation expansion from a basic rigid plate solution. The drag scales like eta squared, curvature grows like eta squared for small eta from being zero, and so forth. It gets more interesting when you're looking for eta large, which is what I'm after here. I want to know where does this 4/3 come from. And so what I want to do is I want to look for scaling behavior near the tip of this deflecting rod. Okay? And so what I want to do is to concentrate myself up in this region and see if there's anything special going on there. Now, I've scaled the problem so that the velocity and pressure are order one. Right? Pressure is zero at infinity. It comes down to a half at the stagnation point. The velocity is one at infinity. It comes down to zero at the stagnation point. So it's scaled to be order one. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a set of scale invariant solutions to the Euler equations. And in particular, I'm going to look at scale invariant solutions that are order one with the rescaling. And so what that means is I'm going to look at solutions, I'm going to seek solutions of the Euler equations, where u looks like some basic scaling function divided through by some power of eta. And the same for the pressure. There's no outside scaling because I have this constraint that is scaled to be order one. So it turns out that if I stick these into my fluid equations, they remain invariant under that rescaling of space. It's just an isotropic rescaling. There's no viscosity or anything like that, so it just lets it, Euler equations just let you rescale. And so this alpha is a so-called scaling parameter, and what it does is defines a collapsing length scale in the problem. So this eta to the minus alpha is a length scale, non-dimensionally, and my choice of a solution that I look for in the Euler equations doesn't pick alpha. It's invariant under choice of alpha. So it turns out that it's the beam equation that's going to choose alpha and some other information. So here's the beam equation. It's 1/2 curvature cube plus 2 derivatives of curvature equals eta squared p. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to seek solutions along the beam that have the same inner scaling with respect to s, the arc length, and some outer scaling for the curvature eta to the beta. Okay, so here's the idea. If I just looked in the tip region as I increased eta, then what I'm getting is a sharper and sharper tip that becomes narrower and narrower. All right, so here in my scaling form that I'm looking for, I have a diverging curvature, so as eta gets big, the curvature gets higher and higher, as it does in the schematic. And the length scale, or if you like, the width, is collapsing. Okay? So this is all you guys in Dave's applied mathematics class should recognize this, I think, or at least appreciate it. Yes?
So assume thin beam.
Yes, that's right.
So does
It holds so long as the curvature length is larger than the radius of the beam. So it has no problem with nonlinear deflections. All right, so it turns out that you stick this into this equation and you determine both of those parameters by asking that all three of these terms come into the balance, or the so-called dominant balance. Okay? And what it means is that alpha and beta are both 2/3. It would have been a little weird if alpha and beta had been different because this is a collapsing length scale and curvature has units of inverse length, so I should have had that alpha and beta came out to be the same. So, and then I end up with a dimensionless curvature equation. Okay, so I've picked now this scale. So as eta grows, the length scales in the tip region collapses eta to the minus 2/3. And my curvature should have this scaling form. All right? Where now, as eta grows, the curvature diverges like a 2/3 power over a collapsing length scale. Oops. Here's my translational motion problem. There's from the code, the numerical results from the code, showing what happens when you take the curvature and you plot it against these scaled variables. So I rescale as a function of eta, the arc length. So this is curvature as a function of s around the tip region. And multiplying the diverging curvature with an eta to the minus 2/3 to bring it back down to being order 1. And again, this is going from 30 up to 3,800. All right, so a couple of decades. And you can see, you're seeing the emergence of a so-called scaling solution in that region where it's really obeying that scaling assumption that I, or ansatz I made on the previous slides. So what's happening is you're seeing the emergence of a self-similar solution in the tip region. Okay? And it's that self-similarity, I claim, is exactly what you need to get that eta to the 4/3 growth. Scaling continued. If curvature has this scaling form, then its derivative looks like eta to the 4/3. Turns out that it's the derivative of the curvature that basically gives the scaling for the drag. And that's because the drag looks like eta squared, the integral of this non-dimensional pressure. That's the integral of the right-hand side of that beam equation. And this looks like the jump in the curvature derivative at the tip. That scales like eta to the 4/3. That's where the drag comes from. Okay? So now, what I find very, I think, interesting in this problem is that the whole drag on this object, in my theory, maybe not in the experiment, but in my theory, the drag is being controlled by apparently just by a collapsing length scale at the tip. Not by the whole body, but by just what's going on at the tip. All right? So I have a length scale for the tip, which is this tip curvature inverse, which looks like eta to the minus 2/3. So somehow I'm getting something that looks like an effective plate whose length scale with velocity is just scaling like eta to the minus 2/3. So I get a self-similar plate or form at the top, which has a geometric invariance with eta, but its length scale is collapsing with velocity. Okay? So that begs the question about what's happening to the rest of the body. What is it doing? I told you about what's going on up here. Okay, what's happening to the rest? In particular, what I want to take a look at is the cross-sectional width of the whole body, L sub W. So the distance between the tips or the ends of this filament, they're being pulled down into the flow. Usually you would like to think that the drag looks like this scaling parameter, rho u squared, times the cross-sectional width of the body. Okay? That's the length that it presents to the flow. But it looks like it's just this width that's coming in. What does this width look like? And then you see something very interesting. So let me plot these two widths for you. Here's that tip width, very low velocities. Then you come in, you have this transition, and there's the eta to the minus 2/3. Here's the width of the shroud, so to speak. This is the cross-section that the flow sees. It actually looks, that L sub W, like eta to the minus 1/3. Now, this is very weird because I seem to be having the drag controlled by the width of the tip, but the width of the whole body is going to zero much more slowly. Okay? So what's happening? Well, what's happening is that as eta gets large, you could think of it, now it's useful to think of it as an effective rigidity. As eta gets large, the rigidity, at least away from the tip, is getting very small, so it's getting very floppy. It's very flexible. It's just starting to act like a piece of the fluid. That's what's happening. It's acting like a piece of the free streamline. So I like to say, outside of the tip region, the body is becoming one with the wake. That's what's happening, with the system length scale being set by the tip region. So here's the basic picture. Here's the tip. Here's this L sub W. And if you look at the asymptotics of free streamline theory, you'll find that this wake width is growing like x to the half, say where x is this direction down from the tip. So it's growing like a square root. And so what's happening in this tip region is that it's also now looking like a square root as eta gets very large, But its length scale is being set by the tip. That's rescaling the whole problem now. It's just the tip geometry. And it turns out that square root of this L tip, A to the minus 2/3 length scale, is what gives you an A to the minus 1/3. All right? So it's getting wide, it's going to zero more slowly than the tip. But it's just, if you actually looked at the pressure in this region, and if my machine were behaving in a reasonable way, I could back up and show you that pressure plot, you would see that the pressure all along here is just going to the wake pressure. It's just going to zero. That part is not incurring any drag. It's just like it's a piece of the streamline. And there's the universal shape. All right? So this is showing the tip region now, again, over this two and a half decades of scaling. This is showing that tip region, X and Y, over many eta's. And you can see they're all just lying on top of each other. It looks rather parabolic, but when you saw its curvature, you saw that that was not a constant at all. Okay. Now, there's some real data. So this I got last week from my graduate student, Silas. And this is now plotting in these dimensionless units the drag data for the rigid plate, which does have some finite rigidity, and the flexible data. Okay? And so we're in the ballpark. It fits on the same graph. So what it looks like is happening here. So here's the rigid stuff, and you can see it's growing with this square. It's a little off, you know, newer experiments. One thing we don't have in here, for example, is the effect of sidewalls. We could also put in a boundary layer correction to account for the other effects of viscosity aside from creating this free streamline, perhaps. And so there's plenty of room to play, but it does look as though this data is capturing somewhere in between a transition. And so it looks like we're kind of bracketing the transition region or something like that, and so we're trying to fill in this data now, actually using glass fibers, optic fiber glass, where it's actually acid-etched to control the width and thus vary the rigidity. So that's what June has been doing lately. And that's all I have to say. Thanks. Yes.
Have you checked the sort of scaling of the actual shape of the fiber that you have in different?
Not yet. So, that's right. We now have this what should be the scaling variables, right? So that's something that needs to be done. We need some software to capture the shape off of, or just draw it, or to capture the shape off of the video. But no, a lot of the data analysis is just starting to get done now. Part of the reason is that June was not satisfied with the nylon fiber stuff, so it's all being redone with these glass fibers. So anyway, it's kind of in the middle at the moment. Yes?
Is that free streamline fly in
3D? No, because you don't have nice conformal mapping methods in 3D. On the other hand, there are other techniques that in principle would. And so a different way of solving this problem could have been by a vortex sheet formulation. Okay? So rather than moving into conformal mapping, use a boundary integral representation for the flow field, since it's irrotational and incompressible. And that goes into 3D. What you have to start worrying about are basically the flux conditions of the sheet off of the body and what are the right kind of continuity and smoothness conditions that one needs for that. But in principle, everything can be done there. Yes?
Not a very mathematical question, but I'm just curious how you control the rate of flow of your coil if you're in a gravity fit.
You have a spigot. You want to slow it down, you close it a little bit.
So
it's literally that. Sure, but that's the viscosity that's the flow through the little pipe,
yeah.
If you like. All right, it has a much different behavior when it's spread out as a thin sheet and running straight down between them.
That seemed very fast. You said 3 meters a second.
The film is 2 microns thick. It's a very thin film. Okay.
To me, I would think it would slow down, but that's just.
Well. What slows it down eventually is actually the air drag on the film itself. Okay, so this thing comes down and it accelerates very quickly. You can even see what almost look like shock waves on the soap film is coming in this out of this kind of diverging domain. It ramps up to about 2 or 3 meters per second, and it's a little complicated actually. Depending on the flow rate, the thickness of the film is some combination of effects that come with the flow rate that's coming from above, for example, and the speed and its terminal velocity. So you can't Well, that's right, and you have to measure the thickness, but typically it's on the order of 2 to 3 microns. It doesn't change huge factors.
Even though you've got such a huge change in velocity.
Yeah. So you can do it, though. Yes.
How long did the calculations take on the computer?
Well, they used to take a really long time, and that's because we were using an iteration in Hereau for solving the conformal mapping problem. Once we had it down to turn it into this Broyden scheme, then basically you're getting something close to quadratic convergence. Then it's just the cost of inverting a big matrix, perhaps, but it's only 1,000 by 1,000. So you can run a continuation code in well under a day. I remember it. Not that. A little bit further. Does this mean I'm verbose? Thank you.
Okay. I like that one on the right. So you have these fringe optical fringes you can see.
Yeah. So this is across this is about a 10 or 20% change in the film thickness.
Right. So I have a question now.
Yeah.
Change in thickness, can you use that as a diagnostic for any of the flow parameters?
Well,
because you notice you had that pressure plot before.
Yeah.
You could somehow,
it's difficult to do that, actually. And the reason is you don't know which way the gradient is going in principle. All you're seeing, I mean, it could be increasing thickness, it could be going down in thickness, and you'd see the same pattern. It doesn't give you a direction.
No, I agree. But what if film thickness were the same as pressure? Then you'd be looking
I mean, in principle, you could do something like that because the pressure variations across the flow will influence the film thickness. But there's also other effects that may be coming in, like the film has an elasticity that may be moderating whatever that relation is. What we actually do is we take a little $35,000 toy called a laser Doppler velocimeter, and we dope the flow with little tiny particles. And what a laser Doppler velocimeter does is actually, again, it sets up a bunch of fringes like this, and the flow brings the particles down through a series of gradients of fringes, and it looks at the flashes, and we get the velocities out that way directly. And it's very accurate. So we measure velocities actually in a point-wise way with this LDV equipment. So, nothing like money.
So, if I understand right, in the way you modeled it, as you were using Euler equations, assuming that the very rapid outside flow
is steady. Yeah.
And obviously you have these other instabilities going on. Sort of qualitatively, what are those going to be doing?
I don't have a clue. So what the effect of instability and time dependence is, I'm just not sure, actually. One big effect is certainly going to be the presence of walls. So we had made some estimates that you might have a 20 or 30% change in drag depending on the wall scaling. But what you really need to do is to do this problem right, and that's not impossible, but it's very hard. And so what we've been working on the past couple of years is actually how do you model the dynamics of a vortex. Okay, so let me say one thing first. So where did this, first of all, where did this sharp transition layer come from in the first place? It came about because there's actually viscosity in the flow, right? So there's a very sharp boundary layer, and it gets shed down in here. So in principle, what we're looking at, we hope, is an infinite Reynolds number limit of the Navier-Stokes equations that contains a flow discontinuity that came about because of the action of viscosity. Okay? Now, you need this slip line in our theory in order to get a drag. There are solutions to the Euler equations that give rise to something that's called D'Alembert's paradox, where if I have a, you can find flows that look like this. No wake, no dividing streamline, just a streamline that goes all the way around the body.
That's a slow flow, isn't it?
No. This is the Euler equations.
So how can I make much of that?
That gives you zero drag. Okay? If you have a closed streamline, if you have a flow that has that form, that gives rise to D'Alembert's paradox, which says this object has no drag in the flow. You needed to have put in this thing that's mimicking the effect of viscosity. Okay? Now, bless you. So what we've been working on, and this is with Marvin Jones, and also my collaborator and colleague, Steve Childress, which is looking at the dynamics of vortex sheets and bodies, but vortex sheets that are being shed off of bodies and perhaps rolling up. So singular distributions of vorticity being shed off of bodies and doing that in a time-dependent way. That has been done for the case of rigid bodies by Bob Krasny, I think, in 1986, and others since then for a rigid flat plate. And we've been looking at more general cases, so curved bodies, bodies that have forces and can move and are so on and so forth. But that's another thing that we're right in the middle of. And that's going to be a while yet, I think. But, yeah.
You see that thing flap like a flag?
This thing.
No, that bridge.
Oh. Oh, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. We haven't seen that. What June has seen is something else, but may not be what I've seen. If you start taking things off a little bit to the side, so you glue it somewhere else, all right, then you can start getting things start moving around in interesting ways. You start to make it look maybe a little more flag-like. I think that these experiments are actually in an intermediate region that if you took the velocity really, really high, higher than we have, then, so to speak, this is really looking like a piece of the streamline which can be very unstable. And so I think you'll start seeing at higher velocities kind of flapping or fluttering behavior. So, but we're not seeing that in these symmetric experiments. Do it with a piece of paper.
Yeah.
So another interesting problem of this class, actually, which is another one we're working on, is paper falling. This is another beautiful problem, which is just a piece of paper as it kind of slides its way down. There's been some very nice experiments done by my friend Andrew Belmonte and his collaborator Alicia Moses on this experiment, where they actually took aluminum strips and put them onto little rings that sat inside of a little channel, and the rings would keep them straight, and they would look as they fell down and look at the changes from having what they call fluttering to things that are tumbling and going down as they change the, for example, the weight of the object that's falling down. So that's another problem we're looking forward to. Anyway, okay. Thank you.